I had to move the dead Elvis. It normally sits right behind me on the shelf. And I had an interview and I had to tidy the mise-en-scene.
Hello, you. Welcome back to List Envy. My name is Mark Steadman and you are listening to the podcast where every week I bring on a special guest and together we collaborate to build a top five list on a topic they choose. This week, I am delighted to be bringing back John Bounds. John was the first person I ever recorded a List Envy with. We did sitcoms of the 1970s. So we are back. And what are we doing? We're just going to move it up a decade. We are doing sitcoms of the 1980s. Listen, I'll be back to have a bit more of a chinwag with you later. But for now, let's get on and start making our list.
I remember being at school. And I was in the sort of primary school, and a bigger boy came in, and he told us all about the last episode of the first series of Blackadder. And when Blackadder 2 came out, I sort of begged my mum to let me watch it, and she videoed it and watched it before to see if it was suitable.
And what did she find?
Well, she let me watch it. So I think she was not a very good parent, to be perfectly honest.
So what's your definition of, I mean, definition of the 80s seems easy enough, but what makes a sitcom a sitcom for you?
Well, in this particular definition of it, we're talking the classic sort of no learning, no development, everything resets at the end of an episode, very few ongoing narrative arcs. And some of the shows I'll probably talk about do have narrative arcs, but they're quite often more to do with the fact they've run out of plot and they've got to change it. And in terms of 80s, I've been very strict. Anything that starts in the 80s is fine. Nothing that started in the 70s but was a sitcom in the 80s, even if it was huge. And obviously nothing from the 90s.
But overlapping into the 90s, we have agreed.
Yeah, that's okay.
Well, with that ado done, let's do well, first pick. What have you got? What's number one for you?
I'm going to go for something very mainstream, something that will get the Mickey taken out of it. The mainstay of English bars in Spain. This selection is very much the Trigger, Del Boy falling through the bar and Trigger making a face of 80s sitcom selections. I'm going to go for Only Fools and Horses.
I will brook no argument. I understand the arguments and that's fine. There's so much good stuff to say about Only Fools. But this is your pick, so please go off, King.
No, but it's quite simply a wonderful series. It tails off towards the end, most of that in the 90s. It certainly changes what it is. In the first series especially, there are a few outdated attitudes. But I would say that they are not as bad as they could be, and they are not untrue to the characters. So it was written by a guy called John Sullivan, who also wrote Citizen Smith in the 70s, and he wrote a few other things afterwards, including a sort of prequel to Fools and Horses, Just Good Friends, and Dear John, which we might talk about later. But the setup's quite normal for a sitcom. Two brothers, in this case, a little bit steptoe-y, trapped in a working class, buying or selling. There's no female characters to speak of. Women are reasons. Rather than butts of jokes, they're the reasons for a joke because they create the conflicts and things like that. And the first couple of series were not particularly popular at the time. Mm-hmm. David Jason was a well-known actor, but not a star, a well-known comic actor, certainly. And Nicholas Lyndhurst had done lots of sitcoms before. Butterflies, famously, where his character isn't a million miles away from how he portrays Rodney. But the writing is absolutely superb. And the fact that it's become such a cultural juggernaut, in the sense that you can't walk into any card shop, gift shop, supermarket without seeing some sort of Fools and Horses branded merchandise, just simply the word Peckham, the actual, any sort of a Reliant Robin van, although it wasn't actually
Batman and Robin.
Yeah, Batman and Robin.
Because, yes, we've got, so you know, there's for any international listener who is not acquainted with Only Fools and Horses, John made an allusion to something very early on, falling through the bar, which if you just YouTube Only Fools and Horses falling through the bar, it's just a very, very simple piece of slapstick that's executed to pinpoint accuracy, as is the chandelier. And there's a lovely little story behind it in that they only had one take because this was a real chandelier they were dealing with. There are two chandeliers in play here in this sketch, in this little vignette, and one has to fall to the floor, and they could only do that once. And so they had this really difficult moment where Nicholas Lyndhurst and David Jason have to be completely stony-faced as the wrong chandelier drops, you know, not the one that they are about to catch. And it's just this wonderful moment that there is a very good chance we would never have seen it, you know, because I remember, I don't know if it was John Sullivan saying it, but I remember a piece to camera, someone saying, if we lose the chandelier, we lose the shot. If we lose the shot, we lose the episode.
Yeah, it's absolutely indelibly printed on the minds. There's a set of stamps recently, Fools and Horses stamps, of which I bought, I don't know if you know this, but you can go on the Royal Mail website and buy like 50 quid's worth of stamps and they'll send you a huge sheet of them, which I did for the Fools and Horses ones, just knowing that it would amuse me to send Fools and Horses stamps out whenever I had to send a letter. And there were only two pictures, at least I got Trigger for Delboy falling through the bar and Trigger making a face, and the chandelier, the look on David Jason's face just before the chandelier goes.
That is a wonderful pick. I'm here for it. It was further down my list, but I'm delighted that it's there. Okay, my number one is, by all definitions apart from technically the BBC's definition, but by every conceivable metric, it is a sitcom. If I give you a clue, it was commissioned by the BBC as a variety show, which is why there is a musical act in the middle of every episode, because there was no more comedy budget, but there was a variety budget. And so if there was a musical act in the middle of each episode, they could call it a variety show. And is The Young Ones.
Yes. Phenomenal. It's a great show. It's not that high up on my list, actually, but for one reason or another. But it is hugely influential. It introduces a new strata of comedians to TV, all of which have gone on to continued great success. I think there's none of them, apart from Mikey was merely an actor. No one is not still a household name, and he's still working. He's not like he is. And it's anarchic. It's fun. It deliberately plays with the conventions of TV rather than sitcom. It's got a sort of a slightly Brechtian structure. It plays fast and loose with the fourth wall and the sort of fifth wall, almost, if you're going to talk about the fact that it'll happily break through into other TV programs. It's a beautiful piece of work. I don't think that it's dated as well as some of the other things we might discuss, but that might have been because it was so groundbreaking at the time that it's difficult to get that shock.
Yes, it was trying to appeal to you know, to a young crowd at the time and the stuff that they cared about. I mean, there was a piece that it must have been legislation that was debated at the time about the drinking age in pubs, because there's the whole bit that Ben Elton presents as a TV presenter that he'd obviously written for himself about how you can fight in the army before you can drink in a pub. And, you know, there's all, you know, obviously those kinds of things. I mean, You've got Rick Mayall. Rick Mayall remains a mystery in my brain. I still don't know. And I don't know why it's Rick Mayall that I specifically think about here, but I just remember adoring him as a kid and always being delighted that he was on and always watching something because he was on it. I don't know what the incepting Rick Mayall media was. I don't think it was the Young Ones. I feel like I already knew who Rick Mayall was then. And then, you know, but there's, I just remember, like, every time Rick Mayall was in anything, I was always, you know, keen to watch it. But I don't remember what the first thing, you know, how I discovered Rick Mayall.
So the genesis of the Young Ones is worth going into a little bit. So these were guys that they were a sort of a Manchester University set rather than Footlights College Oxbridge types, and they'd been working, for the want of a better word, don't know how much they got paid, in the Comedy Store and later the Comic Strip live comedy clubs in London, and it was a very small thing, and it was just like after hours in a strip club as far as the situation goes. It was not, this is not London Palladium, this is not they're not big names, but the energy of their work captivated people, and it apparently just became completely obvious that they were going to get a TV show.
Yeah, lovely. What is your number two, sir?
So I get possibly to the other end in terms of anarchy, although quite anarchic within itself. I'm going for David Croft and Jimmy Perry's holiday camp set sitcom, Heidi High.
I am surprised this was not number one.
I'll admit it's not that funny. No. It's a sitcom which I have a huge, huge, huge amount of love for. It is better, in my opinion, than Croft and Perry's other sitcoms, which probably get more love. Dad's Army being considered an absolute classic and a sort of bedrock of English culture. Hello, Hello, absolutely beloved and getting a little bit of a revival in terms of people really saying that they thought, that, you know, they think it's great. Heidi High is the sort of second chronologically in terms of the life of Jimmy Perry, because Jimmy Perry is one of the writers. He was Private Pike in Dad's Army. He had been a young lad in the Home Guard. That's him. And then when he got a little bit older, he was doing his national service in a concert party in a hot, jungly area, which then formed the basis of It Ain't Half Hot Mom. Both of those are sort of 70s sitcoms, but these 80s classic is what he did when he's on his holidays from RADA, which was be a member of the entertainment staff at a holiday camp.
Wow.
So he's Spike.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow.
Now, the absolute joy for me of Heidi High is its root oneness in terms of sitcom. It is very, very closed set of characters. They almost all have very defined personalities they're not going to step outside from. Everything turns out exactly as it was when it started at the end of each episode. They're the entertainment staff in a holiday camp, essentially, and this is the shenanigans that goes on therein, mostly around them either getting into scrapes because one of them's drunk, or they are trying to fiddle the books or fiddle the campers in one way or another. It's remarkably similar, brilliantly drawn, great actors, most of whom didn't do anything else outside Heidi High, really. That most of them appeared in other David Croft and Jimmy Perry sitcoms, but they were like a repertory company. The chemistry between them is phenomenal. It went on for quite a suspiciously long time. There's like six series, all of which are set in 1 year.
Huh.
They are set, it's totally set in 1959. The fact it's 1959 is mentioned in the first episode, and the end of the last episode is the fact that next year they're going to in 1960 they're going to start self-catering.
Wow, goodness me. Okay, that was a busy year for them. I love it. Okay, thank you. My second pick is Blackadder. This is the show that was described, because I think in series one you would not. I don't think we would have called it a sitcom. Series one is entirely different. It is, I won't make a qualitative judgment on it. I don't particularly, if I'm going to have a Blackadder binge, I tend to skip series one because it's very different. But it does have Brian Blessed being Brian Blessed. It's interesting in that a lot of the characters are flipped, and that Rowan Atkinson plays the buffoon and Tony Robinson plays the sort of sly, he actually has cunning plans that actually are cunning. Rather than the hapless sidekick. It all really starts from Blackadder 2, 3 and 4. And I've put it here because there is something brilliant about what Blackadder was, but when I watch individual episodes, I mostly roll my eyes. So it's a weird thing now. I think I like the idea of Blackadder more now than I like the execution of it.
That's really interesting. I've got Blackadder down as 3, so that's
okay.
I think you're unsurprised that it's in my top 5. I would agree with you that series one probably misses my strict definition of sitcom. Mm-hmm. And it certainly is different in lots of ways to the next three. It's I like it more than I like 4.
Yeah.
I was actually hoping, when I was looking at the dates of this, I was hoping that series 4 was in 1990, so I could go 80s Blackadder is absolutely top notch, 90s Blackadder's fallen off a little bit, but that's not true. It was also 80s, and by the standards of sitcom in general, even series 4, which has become what's the term? There's a Flanderization of the characters have become, despite what I was saying about Heidi High, the characters at this stage, which we thought were interesting characters by series 4, they have become very one-dimensional in lots of ways, maybe apart from Blackadder actually, which is interesting. So series one, set in a false history in between the reigns of Richard III and Henry Tudor. What was he? Is Henry the Fourth? Henry the Third? Henry the Third. Sorry.
There you go.
So lots of cod Shakespeare stuff in it. Peter Cook as the dead Richard III, which doesn't the fact that he's dead doesn't stop him being in some further episodes, which is nice. I think it's really great. Rowan Atkinson. The second series, where they brought young ones writer Ben Elton into the fold, becomes much more sitcom-y. 5 sets, audience, strict characters.
Yeah, very, very cyclical.
Yeah, and resetting itself at the end of every episode, apart from the last one. It's one of the wittiest sitcoms, I think, I've got on my entire list of 80 sitcoms. The script, particularly series 2 and 3, is phenomenal. There's not a line wasted. There's not a word wasted.
Yeah, I really like 3. There's something about 3 that I really enjoy more than I think the other two.
There's something very, I think, interesting about the structure of sitcom. There's almost two classic ways for it to work. The main character is stupid and hence causes their own scrapes. I'm thinking of Some Mothers Do Have Them, or Miranda, or Love Thy Neighbor. They create problems because they are stupid and idiotic and they're doing the wrong thing. And for the most part, certainly series 2, series 3, series 4, Blackadder is the smart one. He's beset by fools. He's beset by circumstances. He's a modern thinking man in anachronistically modern thinking man in an old world, and he's exasperated by the turns it takes and the positions it puts him in. And that's a great classic sitcom trope, which works really well. The writing, Ben Elton again, Richard Curtis is a man who knows how to do milk your emotions at the right time. Ben Elton's a great man for a knob gag. It seems to be a perfect combination there. And as you alluded to there, Mark, with the guest stars, nowhere throughout the series of any of them have they stinted in any way on getting the absolute top comedy performers in there. We're talking Cook, we're talking Blessed, we're talking Nigel Planers in Series 3, Robbie Coltrane in Series 3, Tom Baker, Rick Mayall. These are people who are...
And, oh, God, your man who plays Darling, you know...
Tim McKinney.
McKinnon, yeah. That role that he plays... He plays that so well. There's different versions of that that he sort of plays, but you know, he just plays that particular Tim role to a key. Okay. What's your number three, please?
Well, my number three is Blackadder. So shall I give you my number four?
Please do.
Yes, Minister and Prime Minister
and Prime Minister. That was next on my list. Wonderful.
Well, like I've alluded to this before, Mark. It's difficult to look outside the canon for this because they are remembered so well because they are genuinely good. Yes, Minister, for anybody who's not watched it, is sort of get the thick of it. You take out the swearing, you stop the camera moving around, you take out all physical humour. You essentially add in the fact that the stories have to be massively elongated because there's no fast moving media. There's like episodes that are based around one television episode and it's stretched over like 2 weeks about whether it's been shot and edited and whether they can go back to the BBC and ask them not to do this. It really does show a different pace of life. And when I was looking more deeply and reading back up about it, so the whole premise is Jim Hacker is a government minister, and it's all about his travails with the civil service in trying to get anything done. But everybody thinks they're very smart. No one is quite as smart as they think they are. There's a huge amount of clever wordplay. It's an unmoving farce in many ways. There's no take your trousers off and hide under the stairs. Here comes the vicar, Marjorie.
Yeah, no whoops, mum. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a farce of ideas, a farce of competing personalities and competing ideas and stuff. And it's brilliant for that. But they did broadcast it pretty much as a radio sitcom with no script changes.
I think there was an announcer. If there was any business, any visual business, I believe an announcer explained what was happening. and then it just cracked on.
It's brilliant. And then I think we said about Blackadder being like verbally dense and not a wasted line. There are wasted lines aplenty in Yes, Minister, but in a different way. The characters are, particularly the Sir Humphrey character played by Nigel Hawthorne, is verbally dexterous in a way that we don't understand. None of the rest of the characters are meant to understand. Yeah. That's his stock in trade, by being confusing. And it's wonderful. You can sit back and he'll make a speech for 2 or 3 minutes sometimes and he will have said nothing. And not move the plot on, and that's the point. That's both the point. Yes. But it's wonderful to watch. It's like I don't know. It's like watching Dressage or something.
He is, and I think the Nigel Hawthorne, his face, his delivery, his dryness and sort of disdain, his coolness towards Hacker, and just
that you just don't understand, my dear boy. You know, let me explain, and also let me explain that I'm explaining, and let me explain that my explanation is now confusing you, and that's the point. If you know, there's shades. If I think about the West Wing, there are shades of Richard Schiff's character,
Toby.
Yeah, Toby, in that he is aware of his own rhetoric, and there's that sort of self-awareness, and I'm going to talk to you on a meta level about what this conversation is, kind of thing that I really enjoy. Yeah, it is a wordy ass sitcom. It is wordy, and I like it. I can't pretend to understand what's going on in most of it, but I like it.
But there's an interesting thing, as we were talking about 80s sitcoms, is that this is not how politics was done in the 80s, particularly. It's mostly based on experiences and ideas that had come out of the 70s. And also, it's meant to be a satire of the types of not particularly ideological people you found at the top of politics in the 70s, when the worry about polling and the press started to come into it, rather than the 80s, which had at least one rabid ideologue at the head of it. And it was, in a way, it was a good piece of satire. In a way, apparently, it was one of those pieces of satire that the government absolutely liked, because the Thatcher government were quite happy with the idea that they were being thwarted by the civil service, and it would have been all right if they could have just get things done.
Oh, what a lovely pick. Thank you. Okay, that was my number three. So the only reason this is my number four rather than my number three is because the first two series are in the 80s and then the rest is in the 90s. But it started in the 80s, and arguably its best two series were in the 80s. And it is Red Dwarf. It is, on the face of it, I was almost going to say Porridge in Space, which is not exactly true or fair to either show, certainly not to Porridge. But it is... It's got so many of the same tropes that have worked in sitcom for years. They work in radio sitcom. I mean, there's the wonderful John Finnemore Cabin Pressure, which is the same idea. It's the guy who's very slightly senior, but is either in some ways underqualified or doesn't feel qualified, or just, you know, gets in his own way. And there's the slightly cooler guy who doesn't really care about power or status, but, you know, is nominally the underling, but really sort of, you know, doesn't make the decisions, but sort of kind of has the influence. And so that is, you know, that is Rimmer and Lister, and they are trapped on a mining ship 3 million years in the... Well, it's actually more... It would be more than 3 million years, because David Lister has been frozen for 3 million years, and I'm not entirely sure what year it was originally set in before he got cryogenically frozen. But, you know, he gets frozen. He gets put in stasis while there's a big radiation leak. And everybody else gets turned basically into powder. And all that's left after 3 million years is him, a being that has evolved from the ship's cat and the hologram of... Chris Barry's character, and Holly the ship. And for the first two series, apart from a couple of little excursions, you know, they managed to go back in time. There's a time leak thing. You know, there's not that many other characters. Couple of lovely sort of little bit parts and things like that and excursions. But it is those two series, I think, phenomenal. Took a long time to get going. They had something like four pilots that all got canned, and it finally happened. And there were lots of other things that were put in its way. There were strikes, there was like a cameraman strike and all sorts of things that that got in the way, but it you know, it finally got made. And I am grateful for it because I love it so.
It's not a particularly usual view to like the first two series as much as you do, Mark, but I completely agree with it. I think common thought says that it really kicks off with series three where it starts to expand a little bit, but that,
yeah, when they go into Starbug, yeah,
but that it brightens up a lot in series three. They obviously had some more money, but that sort of there's some really interesting ideas. It's a sort of sitcom of, well, you know, in the whole thing about sci-fi being about the time you're in, but there are lots of really interesting scientific ideas and philosophical ideas in the first two series that are really great. The lines are great. The cast is great. Like, maybe at this point we could bring up, there are a lot of parts for women in any of these we've talked about so far. Are there, apart from there's maybe the standout of Miranda Richardson in Blackadder 2. I'm looking at my sort of draft long list here, and there's so much stuff on it that I was arguing with myself about. Yeah, what a great lot of sitcoms, yeah, we're picking. No wonder our list.
Well, you've still got one to go, I think.
I have, and this is a little bit of an outsider. I've not been able to rewatch this because it's not on YouTube. DVDs are not in print. It's not on BritBox, Netflix, Hulu. It's not on the torrents. You cannot get it. You've got to pay way over the odds for the DVD release. And I'm going to pick my fifth top sitcom of the 80s is Colin's Sandwich.
Oh, wow. Right. I'd looked this up, but I have no idea about it. Please tell me everything.
So Colin's Sandwich stars Mel Smith from Not the 9 o'clock News and from the Bambi episode of The Young Ones as a man who works in the British Rail Complaints Department, who also by night wishes to be a science fiction and horror author. He's a man beaten down by the world, against the world, too clever for the world, but he's not a confident man. He's not going to say anything to the people in the world at all. There's a continually running interior monologue that you can hear, slightly Shades of Peep Show. You can continually hear what he's talking about. Oh, you're going to do that, you're going to do that, I'm going to do this. And it's the few clips you can watch on YouTube are brilliant. And I remember absolutely adoring this when it came out. You see a lot of yourself in it, at least I did, in the sense that writing things was what I wanted to do, and obviously no one was going to let me. They weren't going to let me because I was 10 to 50 in the 80s, but yeah, it was. It's really good. But like I say, it's not, whether it's fallen through the gaps of a sort of a rights issue or whatever, it seems to have almost disappeared off the face of the earth. And that was the main reason that I hoiked it up into the top five, I think, because I can't rewatch it, and my memory of it is probably better than it really is.
Yeah, it's a great premise, and in some ways feels a slightly unusually subtle or nuanced premise for an 80s sitcom. Okay, now I'm going to offer a question to you for my final one as to whether you will allow it or not under your definition. I think this qualifies, having watched an episode of another show yesterday to sort of research it. I wasn't going to pick it, but I thought you might, and so I thought, I wanted to get to know this one. And I think it falls under this definition. Anyway, I'll just tell you that I want to put Alfie Desaine Pet in there, and I would like to hear your opinion first off. Does it qualify?
Ooh, I'd say it's for comedy drama, but I'm willing to be persuaded because it's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful program.
There is a sit in that they are working on the site from morning to night. And so, you know, we know what the sit is. They remain there. I think you can pick up any episode and not be too confused. There is no overarching. I think in maybe the second series, I think the second series was like divided up into sort of two builds, because these are so Elfleda's Aim Pet is the story of a bunch of people, mostly from the north of England, from the northeast of England, who go to work in Germany, as was common at the time, to go and build stuff. I guess probably, well, wouldn't be rebuilding after the war, because it was like 30 years after. But, you know, going to rebuild and, or going to just build stuff. And so these lads would work away from their wives or their girlfriends or whatever for months at a time. Some of them are a bit more world weary, but it, you know, it gave us Timothy Spall. It gave us Jimmy Nail. It gave us understanding that Jimmy Nail could sing. And, you know, it gave us is it Roach? What's his name?
Pat Roach.
Pat Roach. Yeah, who was a Birmingham lad who taught who taught Timothy Spall how to do a West Bromwich accent. it's a lovely show. Again, you know, with quite a lot of these, there will be some very outdated ideas. A show that I have a lot of fondness for. I'm happy if we do throw it out, but I think there is an argument at least to say that it can sit in there.
If we were doing 2000 sitcoms, here's the thing. Sitcoms have changed, and lots of them, which we now would definitely say are sitcoms, have that slight narrative arc, that sort of shot on film, or probably expensive videotape at the time, vibe, that have slightly more drama, and no one has any problems saying that... the Daisy May Cooper things unlikable, is it? That is.
Am I being unreasonable?
Am I being unreasonable? I don't think anybody would have a problem with saying that was a sitcom. And if that is Elfleda's Aim Pet would be, I don't think it sits as an 80s sitcom under my strict definition. But I adore it as a series.
So this is our John then, John Bounds, and our top five list of British sitcoms from the 80s. I should have said that at the beginning and I neglected to, but I'm sure you read it in the metadata. It's a good list, right? I think we've got a good long list or a short list that we're going to make into a final list. Sure, you get it. But yeah, we got some cracking choices there, I think. So I'm very pleased with what we came up with. I always like the fact that I get to speak to an expert on various topics, even though, John is just a friend of mine. John is just a friend of mine. He's not just anything, but he is a friend of mine. And I'm delighted that he is such an expert on TV sitcoms. Now, if you would like to get more of John in this particular episode, in this specific episode, then I devised a little quiz for John. So we will get into that in the bonus version of the show, which you can get if you go to listenvpod.com/plus. That's listenvpod.com/plus. I used AI to generate a quiz, and if memory serves, the quiz was not as accurate as John's answers, which is not unusual. So it's definitely worth a listen, and it is also a way that you can support the show if you like what I'm doing here, and if you'd like to kick in a couple of bucks to say thank you, or just to help keep the lights on, as we say. The lights are in no danger of going off. I will still keep doing this. I don't like it when people say, do this to keep us able to provide episodes to you entirely for free. It's like, either you do this because you love doing it or because you've got another reason. Let's not, I do this because I love it. More and more sort of increasingly, I'm just like, I like making this show. I like making it the way I make it. It's just my cozy little fun time. And if you'd like to share that cozy little fun time with me, then listenvypod.com/plus, you can pop a couple of quid in a month, and that will just show me that you love me. And reciprocation, for now, who knows, there may be other benefits to come, but for now, you will definitely get a version of the podcast without this babble, and with more John. That is this specific episode anyway. So go do that, listenvypod.com/PLUS. So coming up then next week, we are going to some haunted locations. We are checking in with John Olsen, who is an author. So we're going to get all haunted. And then Luke Gallagher is joining me the week after to talk about films that gave us the creeps. We've got Disney's Magic Kingdom stuff coming up. Sonic branding. We've got lots coming up, lots already in the can that I'm excited to bring to you, and more coming as well. So, stay, if you're not following the show already in your podcast app of choice, then listenvypod.com has all the details, and you can even pop your email address in. And all I'll do is just every Tuesday, I'll just email you the episode, no other nonsense, just so you've got it, you know? Nice, that's just the service I provide. So listen, let us get back into the episode. We've got a job to do. We've got to combine our lists now. So yes, let us return and build our top five list of British sitcoms from the 1980s. Well, we now have a tricky task in that we've got to put our final list together. And I'm pleased that we've got a fair bit of agreement here, Mike. So I reckon we've got 1, 2, 3, and 4 here, or I think I've got them in order, but I don't know what we do with number 5. So from 4 to 1, I've got Heidi High, Yes Minister, Blackadder, and Only Fools and Horses.
I'm willing to admit that my liking for Heidi High is possibly not universal,
because we still, if you can still say Heidi High to people in the UK and they know what's happening. Do you know what I mean? It's remained in the culture. We might not know. It's like Ron Seal. We many people know the phrase. They don't know where it comes from. Americans use that phrase now and they have no idea where it comes from.
They use
it
Ron
Seal. It
does
exactly what it says in the tin.
Oh, amazing.
I was going to put the young ones in, but I feel like we've got a Ben Elton already in there. And so I'm wondering how you would feel about a Red Dwarf at number 5.
It dropped out of my top 5 very late.
Just as much as, you know, Colin Sandwich would I'd love to be in there. I just, you know, that's the only other the only other one that we haven't had on our mutual list.
I wonder if I considered it more of a 90s one, even though technically it wasn't.
I know.
Go on, I'm going to give it, yeah. Because I love it. No, I love Red Dwarf. And it,
okay, well, I will ask you the formal question then. John Bounds, do you consent to this list?
It's really hard, but yes. Yeah, let's call that a list. I consent.
Let's rubber stamp it. You've mentioned a couple there. What else was on your shortlist? Well, your long list.
So it was really long. I started off with thinking about, I've got genuine affection for things like Fresh Fields.
Okay, yeah.
3 Up, 2 Down.
Yeah, I mean, Desmond's was, that was, you know, that's one of the shows that gets cited because it was, so this was a show set in a black barber's shop, and it was the first time, I mean, America beat us by a long, by a couple of decades, I think. Well, or a decade anyway, in terms of having basically an all black sitcom, and that's what Desmond's was.
And that's true. It's the first truly successful one. I'm going to, and it's, we talked about all these things being BBC actually, and I'm going to because Desmond's was on Channel 4, and also on Channel 4 was Watching. Also on Channel 4 was Chelmsford 1, 2, 3.
Most of these I have not seen because I was
too weak. Yeah. Chelmsford 1, 2, 3 is worth a watch. You might describe it as sort of like, it's got parallels with Blackadder. It's set in Chelmsford in the year 1, 2, 3,
right.
The native British and the Romans It's very good. I like it anyway. It doesn't really stand the test of time, but it's watchable. It's nice. If you like plebs,
I was going to say, yeah, that's what I was thinking about. Yeah, which I do. I do like plebs. It's a pleasant watch. It's a very easy watch.
I was going to talk about two sitcoms as a pair, actually. They kind of come at it from different angles. There's, the Channel 4's first sitcom, as far as I'm aware, was a sitcom called Fairly Secret Army.
Okay.
Which starred Jeffrey Palmer, who you may remember as the Doctor Who Wanted His Sausages.
Yes.
From Fawlty Towers.
The Magnificent Jowls.
Yeah, or more pertinently, Jimmy, the ex-army officer in Reggie Perrin.
Oh, right.
Now,
okay.
Fairly Secret Army, for want of anything better to describe it as, is a spin-off for that character written by David Nobbs, who also wrote Reggie Perrin. But he's not the same character. I mean, he is the same character, but he has a different name.
Right.
He has some of the same lines. In fact, in episode one, there's a speech which word for word appears in an episode of Reggie Perrin, a really quite long one. All about the people he intends to attract for his secret right-wing army to protect the British state. But it's a very weird sitcom in the sense it was made by John Cleese's works training video company, Video Arts.
Oh, wow.
When Channel 4 had to get these independent production companies, most of which didn't exist at that point. So Video Arts made this. And it really does smack of something that's been made by a workplace training company. there's no laugh track, seemingly no lighting. Everything is ultra naturalistic. Everything shot on set. It's very slow. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting as a sitcom. It's all on YouTube if anybody wants to watch it. Yeah, and I missed it. And I admit, there's some genuine classics we've missed out there, like Ever Decreasing Circles.
To the Manor Born, I think, was an 80s, although it feels 70s.
At least for part. And then you've then got The Good Life, which we talked about in the 70s. We've basically, each of the four main characters from The Good Life got their own starring sitcom. Mm. And three of them were huge hits, and Felicity Kendall's wasn't.
John, this has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much. Where can people find things that you do? I mean, social media is a nightmare, but, you know.
Yeah, very difficult, actually. I've given up on a lot of the old Twitters and all that. If you go to johnbaz.co.uk, I might put something up there if I do anything.
It's probably a book or something.
I don't go on about 70s or 80s sitcoms that much.
No. That's all right. You do other things. You know, people have enjoyed you and will enjoy you for other things.
Weirdly, though, here's a little preview. I'm about to launch a podcast which is about sitcoms.
Holy bunkum.
We haven't fully recorded any of it yet, but we've done lots and lots of work on exactly how it's going to work. The concept is we're going to watch American versions of British sitcoms.
Oh! When can I be a guest, please?
And see which bits that they have changed, even though it remains the same. So it's called Trigger's Broom.
Oh, that's lovely. Oh, my word.
I think we've bought the triggersbroom.us web domain, so it'll probably pop up there at some point. I've done all the graphic design for it, but we haven't done any of the actual recording yet. And we need this might come as a surprise to you, Mark. We've written the theme tune, but we haven't yet persuaded you to record it.
Oh my God. I love this so much. Oh, this is like a little birthday treat for me. Oh, I can't wait. I can't wait to just drink this in. Who are you doing it with?
It's our leopard mate, John Hickman. It's so far, it consists of us doing lots of planning And yes. then watching the US pilot of Red Dwarf over and over again, going, what can we say about that?
Amazing. I can't wait. Okay, well, listener, don't you worry. You will be alerted when this new podcast drops. I will not let that. In fact, you know, if you want to sign up for the mailing list, do sign up for the newsletter, by the way, at listenvypod.com. This is a very, very good reason to do so. And I will make sure that everyone knows that this is coming, because that is, I cannot wait. That is wonderful. John, mate, this has been long and detailed and so much fun. Thank you very much for joining me on List Envy.
There's no one else in the world that I enjoy talking old crap sitcoms with as much as you, Mark. Thank you very much for letting me do that.